From the top players and legends to the very best analysts around the world, from wherever the beautiful game is played, this is BTP. Now, we're talking football.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Beyond the Pitch, and I am your host, Juan Arango. It's a pleasure to be with you. Evan, more of a pleasure, it is a pleasure to be with a gentleman whose career I followed throughout the Twitters and also through LinkedIn and many other platforms. One of the guys that really made, and he's probably going to disagree with me on this one, that really helped make SoccerX what it is today. And it's none other than Mr. Misha Scher over in Moscow. How you doing, sir, other than being cold?
Oh, I'm great. I'm great. It's good to be on. Appreciate having me on.
Misha, look, I mean, again, as I mentioned before, I followed your career, you know, ever since you were working or a main or integral part of SoccerX and the creation of that brand. Tell me a little bit more about how you got into football from a business standpoint. Obviously, I guess if you know, most of the people that know you from a football perspective know how much of a fan you are, know how much you enjoy the game, but more from a business standpoint I'm talking about.
Sure. Well, look, I've loved football my whole life. I grew up, you know, for those who don't know, I grew up in, I was born and raised in Ukraine, or what was then former USSR. So, you know, football was in my blood. I wasn't just born there. I spent 13 years of my life playing very, very competitively. So it's something that I've always had a genuine passion for beyond just, you know, playing and watching. And, you know, it came to a point in my career when I was living in Boston, I was working in investment banking, where I thought, you know, this is my real passion. This is what, you know, this, I'm not really doing what I enjoy, what really motivates me, what would make me get up in the morning. I really want to work in football, and sure, I can't, you know, I'm not going to be a player, but surely I can make, I can make a career on the, you know, on the business side, given, you know, the business, so the business of football at the time, this was, you know, 13, 14 years ago, was really growing. And obviously we know the business of sport in general is big business. So, you know, I just had this, the idea that maybe that's what I need to do. And I ended up applying for a program at Liverpool and did my MBA, a specialized MBA to work in football industries. That's kind of what it was. I literally came over to England with a couple of, you know, with two suitcases and, you know, a bit of a pipe dream that I'm going to make it in this industry. And I'm going to get to do, I'm going to get to be around the people that I've only ever seen on TV, or I get to do things that that I've only ever read about. So that's kind of, you know, that's in short how the journey, and I ended up getting a great opportunity out of that. The NBA gave me a foot in the door. It exposed me to a lot of different aspects of what football industry is all about, and I had an opportunity to meet some incredible people who were doing things, Rick Perry's and David Dean's of this world. So it was incredible for a guy who was trying to break in to be building relationships with people like that. So, and I got a great opportunity out of that to go to SoccerX, which, you know, at the time was a relatively small company, but was doing some amazing things. And, you know, again, for those who don't know, it was really in the business of bringing decision makers and movers and shakers from this big world of football together in one place. So it didn't, whether that was clubs or sponsors or agencies or suppliers or federations, leagues, anybody who was doing anything in the industry, we were bringing together. So again, as you can imagine, not only was it great to be a part of a business that was really growing, but to be, you know, for someone who was trying to get into this industry, to be surrounded and basically be paid.
That's the nice part, right?
to network and get to know this industry and these people intimately was something that really set me up for my career and, you know, in the game.
Misha, again, just to get a little bit more of a context of what you're mentioning and what you're doing, this was about when? Early 2000s?
This was mid-2000s. This was mid 2000, 2005. Okay.
2005. How was the landscape back then? I mean, for many of those younger entrepreneurs, football fans, and you know, combinations of all of those particular categories. How was the football landscape back in 2005 from your end, I'm talking about, compared to how it is now in 2017, where you see, I mean, the field actually very diluted now?
Yeah, I mean, geez, it's a completely, you know, it's a completely different world in many ways. I mean, it's not just related to football, but in general, I think what we've seen, you know, and I suppose the biggest thing that's happened in the last 15 years is how it's basically how technology has changed the world, right? And then and how and really how it's transformed you know, the way that people consume the game of football. So you know, what do I mean by that? I think traditionally football clubs they existed in the confines, for most part, in the confines of their, you know, of their cities, and obviously some of the bigger ones, had following in other parts of the world. I mean, I remember when I was in early 2000s, when I was trying to watch, the Premier League, or there was only maybe Fox Sports World or some, you know, a handful of channels at the time where you could actually catch one, you know, a couple of games. I mean, it wasn't what it is today when you can turn on the TV and watch anything you want, anytime you want. And I think what's been interesting to watch is how, and obviously with what's happening with social media, is how it is, it's at the same time has enabled all these people, millions of fans, soccer fans, much more connected to the games and the players and the competitions that they follow. Because now, you know, we went from a world in 2005 where you were mostly a, where you come to a stadium where you watch it on TV, and, there's no role for you to play. Now fans are participants, they have the ability to, to comment, to share, to engage, and now you have all this technology that allows you to get behind the scenes and get closer. So I just think, and obviously as a business, it's become, as a result, it's become a lot more global. People in Malaysia or in Australia or in Argentina, from all over the world, they now have access and can follow. Mm-hmm. They can follow and be almost as connected to some of the teams and the players as those of us who perhaps live in London. I mean, I know for instance that my family, my dad can watch some of the games that are happening in my backyard that I can't watch. I mean, this is where that's where we've got to now. So I think a lot more people, it's helped to build a closer connection between the players and the fans.
And it's funny you mentioned that, because you said you started in like 2005, and that's when things started getting at least moving from a social media, if you want to use that particular term aspect. I mean, YouTube gets started then, and it slowly started to make its imprint. But overall, from your standpoint, what did you see in 2005 that you're like, hey, this could work? This is not working so much. I mean, how has, from an administrative standpoint, from a business standpoint, has the game changed from your perspective?
How's the business? I mean, again, I think that, what's mm-hmm. changed is that everyone, there was the opportunity to bring the game, to more people, right? I mean, again, it's just, here's the most popular sport in the world, and at best, what we're doing is showing occasional games on television, and a team once in a while will go into certain markets. Whereas as it turns out, there are millions and millions of fans all over the world. League. And actually, you know, didn't really have the opportunity. There wasn't the ability at the time to bring these people under your umbrella, right? It just didn't exist. And I felt that there was a real there that something was going to happen. And you know, obviously at the time it was difficult. No one could have predicted the pace at which it happened. But you know, even I say it was accelerated in the last. In the last sort of 5 years, because I think 5 years ago, you know, Liverpool only had social media in English, for example.
Yeah.
Right. So it's crazy to think, but, you know, but someone in, you know, when you have 100 million fans, let's say in China, probably a good idea to find a way to communicate with them and, you know, in their own language. So it's, you know, it was things like that. And I felt that where sport was such a big business, and they really sort of, and in American sports, they really understood, you know, how to really create an incredible experience for, you know, for a fan, right? So how it just, when you go to a game, it's an event, and it's like for a kid to go to Disney, they think of every little step, every sort of touch of a fan experience. And I was going to Europe, and I was going to games in Europe. I didn't see any of that, right? So it was very. It's still sort of, you know, basically the only thing that mattered was the product and the pitch, and that was it, right? So it's like, yeah. Well, so long as we've got a decent team, then you know nothing else matters. And now they realize that it's about how we, how do you bring people through the door? How do you bring the next generation of fans through? How do you genuinely connect with people when these days they can do anything, right? So, you know, football is a huge sport, but it's a leisure activity, right?
And yeah, of course.
And, you know, now you have young people who are growing up and they have, you know, there's no shortage of choice for them in terms of what they can do in their free time. There's Netflix, there's football, there's esports, there's all sorts of things. So I think, there was a real, we used to operate in an industry where, you know, football was king and, you know, nothing else really rivaled it. And I think that's, you know, now that's changing. And I think that's upped everyone's game.
So pretty much what you're saying is that now the interest isn't to bring the fan to the pitch per se, it's to continue bringing him in, not just to bring him in once or twice, but to be able to have them on more than one occasion come and then return again. This is pretty much
absolutely. I mean that it's how do you actually, you know, now you have the ability to build to build that affinity with people, right?
Yeah.
So we live in a world now where, you know, so much is about personalized experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
So people want, you know, it's when you see an ad and it's got nothing to do with you, it annoys you, right? Because you feel like it's you know, what's this got to do with me? And it's interrupting my experience and things like that. So, and I think where, you know, where we've got to now with sport and with data. And again, there's some interesting facts that, you know, that I've come across over the years that, you know, 95% of, or if not more, you know, of sports fans actually don't live, you know, in a catchment area or, you know, in the cities where they, you know, of the team that they follow. So what does that mean? You know, I mean, it's a huge, you know, think about that for a second. How do you as a, you know, as Manchester United or as Arsenal or as Chelsea, how do you make someone in Manila feel like they're part of your community? How do you make them feel, despite the fact that they're on the other side of the world, that person has, that there is a genuine relationship that they can have, you know, with your football club. You know, now there's the ability to do that. They understand that person isn't going to come to Stamford Bridge, probably ever, but that doesn't mean that person is not passionate. It is they don't follow the players. They don't have, you know, there aren't other ways, you know, to keep these people, you know, to keep that fan base and keep these people engaged and make them feel like they're part of, you know, like they're part of something. Because that's what it is. Fans, you know, it's being a fan is a communal thing. You know, most of the time you want to be, you know, yes, they like the sport, but more importantly, they like to feel like they're part of something. That's why people get together. That's why people go to the stadium. It's because of, you know, it's because of that social because of social component. So now, there is the ability, and we're going to get into that even more now in the coming years with, you know, when we have VR and things like that, where you can be in Melbourne, you can put on a VR set, and you can feel like you're sitting in the cop at Anfield, right? So,
you're right. It's gotten to that point where the technology allows you to have that feeling, that sensation that you are at, you know, X, Y, or Z pitch. I mean,
I think that's great. Yeah. And I think that's great because, you know, because we're, you know, what technology has done is basically made the world smaller. It's broken down some of the barriers that used to exist. It was hard because of the, you know, because of the distance, because of the language, because of all sorts of things, time zones, you know, to make people outside of your city or your country, fans in particular, to make them feel, they're part of your football club.
Yeah.
That's no longer the challenge. So now you have, the more sophisticated clubs are, you know, have very specific and targeted sort of approaches, strategies, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
To engage with people in Thailand and Brazil and Australia, in China, in India, and I think this is where, and that's, I think that's great. I think it's great if you can find a way to make people who are far, who have an affinity for your, for the game and for your team or for your players, give them an opportunity to feel close. I think that's the biggest thing that we've seen one of the biggest things that we've seen since I've been in the industry.
Yeah, well, we're here with Misha Shear Beyond the Pitch. And Misha, I mean, you get it. And that's the reason, one of the reasons why I brought you here invited you on the show. And you're talking about the teams that get it, those Manchester Uniteds, the Chelseas, City to a certain extent in the past decade or so. And you start seeing other teams that are slowly getting it, the Barcelonas, the Real Madrids of the world. You also see PSG getting into the mix. And part of your job is to be able to find out what they're doing right. And you've mentioned a lot of those things. Now, there are a lot of teams, and you mentioned earlier that talk about, well, the product is just only on the pitch and that's all that matters. And we still have a lot of that mentality in certain places. One of the places that at least I see it from a European perspective that tends to have that is Italy. What's being done wrong, or what needs to be done right? I guess I should shift the focus a little bit in order to have those teams get to that level or start to reach that level or make the gap between those teams that get it and the ones that don't a little bit smaller. What do they need to do or what needs to be done in order to be able to at least share the spoils on the commercial and on the social end as well?
Sure. Well, I think the Italian question is a bit loaded because the biggest difficulty you have in Italy is the stadiums. You know, that's where it starts. So, just think about it this way, as a football fan, as any fan, right? When you turn the TV on, if you see empty stands, you don't want to watch it, right? It doesn't matter where, you know, who's playing. I've turned a game on last year, and I think it was Roma Lazio or Roma Inter Milan, and it was a half empty stadium, and my initial reaction was, this is crap, right? So when you see that on TV, my thought is if no one there is bothered to watch it, then I don't care to watch it. And I think the problem you have in Italy is that traditionally they have these huge stadiums that were owned by the cities, mm-hmm. right? So and the problem is that there is when the stadium is owned by the city, it's not it, there is no incentive and there's no model for the individual teams to monetize that venue. It's different when it's your venue, when you build it with your own commercial model in mind, then you have the ability to run it your way. When it's owned by a municipality, which traditionally most of the Italian stadiums are owned by the city. That's difficult, you know, that's difficult to do. And they were completely, you know, they were stadiums that were completely out of date. That's the other problem. The second issue that Italy had for, and this is what killed Italian football, or had a major impact on Italian football, is the way they used to share revenue, right? So it's the same kind of problem they had in Spain. So the reason England, the Premier League, has had so much success is because they understood from the very beginning that ultimately it's about creating a very successful product. It's not about, yes, it's important for Manchester United to be good and for Chelsea to be good and for Arsenal to be good, but more importantly, what needs to happen is for Swansea to be good, right? And for Crystal Palace to be good. And for when there is an element of surprise, when we know that on any given day one team can beat another team, that's when you have a healthy product. That's when people all over the world tune in and watch. Yes, more often than not, those top teams will end up will end up finishing in the top 4, 5, 6. But you now have a league where Huddersfield can beat Manchester United. That happens, right? Where, you know, Palace can beat Chelsea. This, you know, that's the beauty of the Premier League. And it's because they've taken the money that they generate and they distribute it in such a way that, yes, you still favor the bigger clubs still get the advantage, but the smaller teams are able to be competitive and are able to put on a team that compete at that level. In Italy, what used to happen is, you know, you had these top teams, 2, 3, 4 teams, who basically took all the TV money, right? And they sold them individually. So AC Milan sold their own TV rights, and, you know, Juventus did theirs, and, you know, Inter Milan did theirs. So as a result, you have a league that's completely lopsided, right? Same thing they had in Spain.
Yeah, of
now
course.
Now Spain has gone to a collective model. And the third problem that they had in Italy is obviously the match fixing, right, and the corruption. So the one thing that will always kill a sport anywhere is, you know, if people lose trust in it, right? If people think that the result is a foregone conclusion, they won't go. You know, that's the whole premise of sport, is there's an element of surprise. People want to know that, you know, they're watching a legitimate competition, that, you know, whilst one team might be better than the other, that it's not predetermined. So when you take all those things together, when you have outdated stadiums, when you have and we have a revenue share model that only favors very few, and then you have and then you put corruption on top of that, that brings football down. Now, you know, you're seeing in Italy they're slowly coming around. They're looking at a different, obviously, television model now. They're building stadiums that are much more suited for football. I mean, look at the stadium that Juventus built, right? So it's, you know, it's smaller.
What Roma's doing, or planning on doing.
Yeah, what Roma are doing. So obviously the other, you know, the Milan club. So that's what you need. You don't have to actually look very far. Just look, look what stadiums, soccer specific stadiums, have done for Major League Soccer.
Exactly.
Soccer's so much about, yes, it's great to have a nice product on the pitch, but again, ultimately, it's about having a home. And a lot of when I look at some of the footage in the U.S. from Portland or from Kansas City, I mean, Kansas City, right? So you wouldn't think it was a heartland of soccer, but they built a stadium and they created an environment that was built for fans. Everything was designed, with a fan in mind, right? And when that happens, fans buy into it. They have a great atmosphere. It's great to watch on TV. It's great to be there. It ends up being a great product. You know, in Italy, you know, when Berlusconi, was in charge of Italy and was obviously running his media empire, his whole goal was to basically to make it so that you could watch anything on TV, that people wouldn't have to go to the stadium. Well, he's achieved it.
And those are the problems sometimes when you start to do that, when you start to really make it about watching it on television over having an experience in the stadium. And I guess that's like you mentioned, Roma, Juventus, even now Atletico Madrid,
Yes.
Looking to do that as well with their new stadium as well. So, I mean, it shows you how much a new venue is going to work as far as that's concerned. And interesting, you mentioned Major League Soccer with Portland, with Kansas City, this past year with Atlanta as well,
yeah.
The experiences there. How do you see, I mean, how do you see the game changing on this side of the pond from 2005 to 2017? I mean, we're talking about not two completely different situations. We're probably talking about two completely different planets, despite the United States not qualifying for the World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I get asked this question all the time. When I was, when I was graduating from, I went to school, I went to university in Ohio, I went to Ohio Wesleyan. So, you know, when I was coming out, I was training with the crew, and you know, it'd be crazy for your listeners to hear this, but when I was there, Columbus Crew Stadium was the only soccer specific stadium in the country. Right. I mean, it looks like a high school football, you know, it looks like a high school stadium with bleachers now, given, if you look at what Atlanta have built, you look at what, you know, Kansas City and some of the others have done over the past, 10, 13 years. I mean, it's incredible. It really, really is. And I take my hat off to Don Garber and the rest of the team at Major League Soccer, because I was always, coming over from Ukraine, actually taken off in a big way. I always felt that, everything about soccer was really un-American, right? I'll be honest, just because, it's, in a culture that's been, think about. The sports that are big, they're American made, right?
Yeah.
People love it, their sport, and they're good at it, right? So, and they embrace it, basketball. But with soccer, it was always seen as that kind of, it's Europeans, and it's not, it's not that cool, and, we're not very good at it. So, America, we like the best, we like winning. So I think there was a real, and also I just couldn't see people sitting there when they watch other sports, and the other sports were made for television, right? It's all commercial, stop. They can go and get some food, they can come back. Soccer is not like that. You have to sit there for 45 minutes and watch the game. So you can't, it was difficult for me to see how that was ever going to change, that you would actually have people who want to come and watch the game and appreciate for what it is and see a game that's 1-0 and actually think they had a good time. But more importantly, for any sport to grow and take off, it needs television. And I just couldn't see how television would ever put on soccer. Not in, in America, where so much of it is all about advertising and how are you going to, who is going to want to carry a game that's where there are no stoppages. But look, I think, as time has shown, the Don and the team at Major League Soccer had a much longer plan and understood that there was something going on. I think they understood the demographics. They understood that it wasn't a 1-2-5 year plan. That it was 15 25 years and getting the right sort of investors on board who believed in. Who believed in where the game was going and investing in soccer-specific stadiums, which we've seen pop up everywhere, with the exception of, I think, New England. I suppose in Seattle as well. But yeah, I mean, it's incredible, because at the time I was living in Boston, and I used to go to New England, and you sit there with, I don't know, even if you get, let's say, 18,000 people, which is a really good crowd for a soccer game. I mean, it's not great. It's not great.
Yeah, it looks cavernous. It really does.
And they're still, same with JFK when DC United played there. But what you've seen since then is there's been a huge investment made in building the venues. And obviously the people are still, I think people are still, critical of MLS, perhaps. I don't know why, because they compare it to European football, but they have to remember that these leagues in Europe, they've been around for in many cases 100 years, right? So it takes time. All these things take a little bit of time, but you know, I think all the, when you see, David Beckham go there, when you see, Andrea Pirlo and Lampard and some of the other players, David Villa, who are going and playing, and now you have players who are going there not just to retire, but in many cases, mm-hmm. they've got quite a few years left on their belt. I am around a lot of players, and I know how much appetite some of the best players in the world today have appetite to go and play in America. And I can see them coming not at 35, but maybe at 31. I think you have to have some perspective about this and where the league is today and firmly established as a proper professional league in what is an incredibly competitive sports landscape with NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, college, NCAA. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's carved out a niche, and I think it's great.
And it's interesting all the things you do say about MLS and what they have done and done very well and all that. And how much impact do you see out from the outside because of a league being so closely tied to its national team? How much of an impact can it have from a performance standpoint and from your specialty, of course, from a more marketing standpoint, not being able to go to the World Cup? I mean, what's being said in Moscow? I know you just landed, but yeah. Have you been speaking to people about that?
I've been speaking to people, obviously, over the course of the past month since the unfortunate result. And, yeah, I think people are quite shocked. Just obviously disappointed because, US has had such a great run over the, I don't know how many World Cups. I can't remember when was the last time we didn't qualify, but I think 86, right? So it's difficult. It's difficult to think that it's such a big, such a big country where soccer has grown so much is not going, it's not going to be, it's not going to be present. Obviously, mm-hmm. it's not great from a commercial point of view because it is the biggest market. And people genuinely, when it comes to the World Cup, they maybe not everybody gets behind the MLS, but when it comes to the World Cup, people genuinely get behind the national team and they watch. So it's really disappointing. But again, I would urge people to have a bit of a bit of perspective. I've done some interviews since then, and people have, it's all been doom and gloom, and this is it. You've got to break up the system, and I just think these things happen from time to time, and you just have to look at, are there things that could be that could be changed in terms of development, mm-hmm. or in terms of how sort of what we do with the league or how we develop young players, and perhaps have a bit of a look at that. But I would remind people that, in 94, when we hosted the World Cup in the U.S., in 1990, when the World Cup was in Italy, mm-hmm. France didn't qualify. And they also didn't qualify, for the tournament in the U.S. in 94. And, for anyone who follows football, you'd know that they won the World Cup in 98. So it's, in France, I would say, probably has some heritage,
just a little wee bit.
There were European championships, they were European champions in 84, had a great World Cup in 86 with Platini. And then it happened. Have now a situation where Holland didn't qualify for the European championships or the World Cup. I mean,
They were in a final. They were semifinalists back to back, and all of a sudden, wheels just came off. Yeah.
So exactly. I think these things, unfortunately, they happen, and maybe we should just I'm not saying we should be celebrating that, but maybe it just shows that the sport in general has grown. The fact that you wouldn't have expected teams like Costa Rica or Panama or Trinidad, to be competitive 20 mm-hmm. years ago, and they're more competitive now, and there are very few games, or if any, where you can turn up and just go through the motions, and that's just it happened, and we just have to we've got to move on, and it's disappointing, obviously, from a broadcast and a commercial point of view, but mm-hmm. they're still, you know, let's remember, there's still, you know, Mexico's still in it. A lot of people follow that. And some of the best, you know, Ronaldo, Messi, Brazil, Argentina, all those, you know, Germany, France, there are some great players who are going to be at this World Cup. So we just you know, I still think it's going to be a great tournament.
Now, moving on a little bit to what you've been talking about and your purpose in Moscow right now, what is it? I mean, I know you're not working with SoccerX anymore. You're more of, correct me if I'm wrong, you're more like of a consultant now. You do some consultant work with them in that sense, because I know they have an event going on in Dubai in the next few days.
Yeah. No, I mean, now I'm still very close with them, and mm-hmm. they have their event, and I still, I run sport and entertainment, sports marketing business, at Mediacom. The agency is called Mediacom, and we're part of WPP Group, which is a huge kind of media advertising conglomerate with, you know, hundreds of companies. So, you know, our core business is, you know, advising companies, major advertisers, on how best to invest in sport, how to leverage the power of sport as part of their, you know, as part of their marketing, you know, in a nutshell. You know, part of our business is also working with talent. So, you know, we work with certain players to on their personal brand, help them build a profile, everything from, you know, how do you position yourself, how do you build a social following, how do you bring out some of the things that you're passionate about and connect with people and things like that. I've obviously been very fortunate to work with Pelé for the last 5 years, you know, on his brand and his commercial partnership. So, you know, I'm here, you know, Pelé is going to be here tomorrow. You know, he arrives, but I'm here sort of as part of all the festivities that are happening around, you know, around the draw, but there'll be a lot of people here who I know. I've got quite a few, you know, I'm seeing some clients, I'm seeing some, you know, and just generally seeing a lot of people who, you know, who I know in the industry who will be here.
Yeah, well, I will probably be seeing you in June when the World Cup rolls around. I'll be in Russia, so.
Oh, so, great.
So hopefully we end up crossing paths too. But overall, I mean, and you talk about what you do now with your clients, branding and all this other. How do you guide them nowadays in 2017? Or how would you guide them, especially if they're a media company or if they're a brand or a company or a corporation that deals a lot with information more than anything else? How do you do that? Because that's one of the things that's really changed, the amount of information that all the individuals out there are able to access. How does that change your job? How does that change your perspective and how you offer that to the client?
Yeah, well, actually that's, you know, that's a great question, because that's at the core of what we do. So, you know, it's not a, you know, when we work with a client, let's say it's an insurance company, let's say it's Allianz, or let's say it's Coca-Cola, whatever. You know, all these different companies, no, it doesn't matter what business they're in, maybe it's Apple. They are, you know, they're all in the business of trying to connect with their consumers, right? So, and it might be to engage with them. It might be wherever they might be on that journey with the consumer. They might just try to raise awareness because they have their new company, or maybe they have a new product, or they're trying to get you, they're trying to get you from someone who considers their product to purchasing and things like that, right? So, you know, it's our job to work with these companies and to see what exists, what's out there in the market. And this isn't, by the way, limited to football. It could be any sport. It could be any entertainment. And to help them understand that, hey, the audience that you're trying to reach, given all the data that we have, and we have access to the third largest data set in the world after Facebook and Google, is your audience is really, is perhaps in cycling. Or maybe it's in sailing, or maybe it's in rugby, right? So we can, you know, all of them will know who it is that they're trying to reach. Sometimes it's 18 to 25 year old young males, and sometimes it's, 25 to 35 year old, middle class or well to do, mm-hmm. you know, families, or it might be someone, it might be companies who are, whose business is mainly B2B, and they're trying to reach, you know, their aim is to use sports, you know, not just to connect with people, but also to be able to tell their story, right? So how do we, this is where sports incredible is that it provides you with a platform to actually say something about your product. And it's not just branding, let's say, well, here we are, have a look, it's Coca-Cola. But, you know, it could be, you know, maybe it's GoPro, and you integrate as part of your, what GoPro is doing, you integrate that product into the actual action of what's going on. I think GoPro actually do that with NHL, right? So they put, you know, they put the camera on the goalkeeper and some of the players, and now you can, the fans who follow the sport can actually see the sport and follow the action in a completely different way, right? So here's a product, here's a company that sponsors the NHL, but integrates its product into the actual game, which allows fans who watch, you know, to watch them to enhance, you know, enhances their experience, right? So, because now they could see, now someone who's sitting at home or someone who's sitting in the stands can see what it feels like for a goalkeeper to have a 100-mile-an-hour puck coming at him, right? So something, so our, you know, our job is to work with these companies, identify, you know, what exists in the marketplace that will allow them to reach the people that they want, as often as they want, in a way that they want, right? So, you know, is there the opportunity to, you know, to elevate their story, and to build genuine affinity with the people who are they're trying to reach? That's the power, you know, that's the difference between traditional advertising and what you can do in sport, because people who, you know, people who watch football or people who watch sport are emotionally connected to that, you know, to that experience. So when you can successfully introduce your company into that experience and add value and enhance what's going on, that's how you build equity, and that's how longer term you can hopefully you influence people's behavior by driving consideration for one product over another.
That's a good, I like that answer, because the reason I say this is because I like to hear that, because myself, within my line of work, within journalism, I always ask that question to people that are influencers as far as communication, as far as information, and the distribution of, as far as that's concerned, especially nowadays. I mean, just you know, by the time we're going on air, a couple of hours ago, 150 people were laid off over at ESPN yet again. And you see the platforms not necessarily being reduced, but I guess they're morphing into something else. And so far, there's certain industries that haven't understood where the footing is or where they can find the actual footing. And so far, and I've asked guys like you, I've asked guys like Gary Vaynerchuk, how do you get this type of information out there when you're, for example, a journalist or a media corporation or an outlet of minor outreach, and pretty much what you're saying really fits into that type of narrative as well. You know, being able to tell the story and being able to help the connection between you and the audience is concerned as well. But of course, good.
Yeah, I mean, that information is not readily available, of course. I mean, that's the, you know, people talk about, you know, obviously we have an enormous amount of information generally out there, right? People, you hear so much about data. I mean, it's sort of, you know, it's a bit meaningless, you know, to most people, because, you know, what does that mean? And, you know, why is that good or why is that bad? But, you know, when you can, you know, if you have the ability to actually use, you know, use certain types of data to be able to inform decisions and make you, you know, make you more efficient in what you do, then that's, you know, that's very, very powerful, right? So, you know, what we're trying, so before, when we didn't have that data, you're taking your, so much of what you do is a bit of a gut feel or an educated guess, or it's based on, you know, perhaps past information or performance or whatnot. Well, now, you know, you can access a lot of data in real time, right? So I can tell I can go to, you know, to a company I'm advising, I can say to them that, look, these people who you're trying to engage with, this is what they like, this is what they read, this is when they do it, this is the kind of stuff they share, these are this, you know, the, all that information is available to me now. It's available to me because I, you know, because I happen to work for, you know, for the biggest media investment group in the world. You know, so that, you know, that helps, but you know, but that's what we use, you know, in a sports marketing sense, we then lean on that data and we apply it, you know, we apply it in our, you know, in what, you know, in what we do, because ultimately we're trying, you know, we're trying to eliminate that sort of guesswork and really zero in on how do we help businesses really leverage the power of sport and understand how to navigate this, really, you know, this, where do you even start, right? I mean, yeah. There's the NFL, there is college, there is football, there is rugby. If you go to different countries, it's cricket, it's AFL. I mean, you just, Formula One, where do you start, right? And where do you end? So I think that, you know, we're able to, you know, we can, depending on what our clients want, we can zero in on the, you know, on the country or the region and quickly identify what exists in, you know, in the sports environment where their message would sit well.
Misha, and we're with Misha Scheer here on Beyond the Pitch. Misha, you, of course, dealing with this, and you're talking about everything that you've mentioned, but then you have a client that comes up and you try and say, hey, well, you need to start looking into football. And then they come to you and say, have you seen the state of football right now? Have you seen how all the corruption and all this and all that? How do you deal with that? How do you deal with saying, well, no, it's not necessarily like this, but yes, it's not necessarily like that either. How do you try and sell someone in a sport where there's a lot more controversy going on off the field than there is on it?
Well, as it you know, as it happens, actually, I sit on a committee at Sports Integrity Global Alliance, SIGA. It's a relatively new organization, about 2 years old, which came as a result of all this of everything that's been happening in sport in terms of corruption, bribing, match fixing, and the sort of the state of sport. And the idea is that, you know, we have to come up with. You know, we have to come up with a set of rules and standards that governments and you know, and private sectors and everyone who's involved in the safety and the future of sport is a stakeholder, right? And they participate in those discussions. When it comes to advising our clients, these things are difficult to predict, and we make them, we obviously make them aware of any issues or any concerns that we might have with a particular sport or with a particular team or organization. I don't think that there is a problem with football as such. I think we have some serious problems within football, but I don't think there is a problem with the sport. I mean, there are certain problems that we have in some countries or in some organizations, but you have to take there's always going to be when you make these kind of investments, there's always some element of some risk. We try to minimize that by doing the due diligence and, you know, making sure that we've dotted the I's and crossed the T's, and there is nothing about that recommendation that that concerns us. We often do that with talent, because I think this is much more relevant when you're advising a client on who to sign as a brand ambassador, because now you're talking about an individual, and that individual could one day just go off the rails. They can make a remark that's inappropriate, or they could be intoxicated, they could be infidelity, or what have you. These things unfortunately happen.
Yeah, they happen. Yeah, life happens.
And, you know, yes, and it happens. Yeah, it happens. More often than we like. So we try. Yeah. We try to make sure that if we ever advise on these kind of relationships, that we do the due diligence and we make clients aware of any concerns that we might have, but also make sure that in any of these in any of these partnerships that their whole sort of equity, everything that company has is not all tied up in that one individual or in that one relationship, because I think people understand and will forgive someone that, hey, they couldn't have known that something was going to happen, right? It's all about how you react if it does, right? So
of course
we've seen, we saw what happened with Tiger Woods, and you had Accenture and others turn around and walk away. So no one held it against Accenture that they were his sponsor, and what was important is that they felt that they needed to act when the allegations came to light, and they didn't want to be associated with that, and they dealt with it. So I think I think it's more about it has less to do with the association, which there is some element of risk. It has more to do with how these companies react when something does go wrong, and how do you manage those kind of situations
as a reputation person. No, I mean, you make valid points with all that, Misha. I mean, when I won the lottery, I definitely want to get you in as an advisor. So just keep that in mind.
Okay.
I will come knocking at your door the day that happens. So just be well aware of that. Where can people find you? And again, I want to thank you for being on the show, and just wanted to be able to say thank you for your time and for your information, for your knowledge as well. And again, thank you for being on. Where can people find you on social media or on other platforms to be able to ask you more questions, to be able to find out more about what you do and also what you do for other clients?
Sure. I mean, look, I can, people can find me on LinkedIn. They can find me on, on Twitter, on Instagram. Twitter handle is at Misha Share. I'd be happy to. I've had many people over the years when I've done these kind of shows reach out, email, maybe interested in particular parts of what we do, or many people reach out just because they're interested in career advice or something along those lines. I'm always happy to make the time, and appreciate the interest, and so yeah, I'm on, connect with me on LinkedIn, send on Twitter, on Facebook, Instagram,
but wherever wherever you'll make the time.
Those, yeah, all those. I'm you can find me whatever suits.
Misha Share, again, thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you for being so generous with your time. I really appreciate it. Best of luck with over in Russia. Stay nice and warm while you can, and wherever else you go afterwards, may the travels be very good to you.
Thanks, Ron Juan. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.